News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Here's to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Here's to Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, here's to your health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Here's to Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And on our show today, we're going to be talking with Dr. Alex Creighton about shoulder injuries, which I think almost everyone gets at some point in time in their life. So I think it'll be really interesting, Christy. And speaking of interesting, we actually have something to talk about in research that matters that really also affects just about everyone at some time in their life.
Yeah, our first article is about low back pain. I mean, this is extremely common.
Have you ever had it?
Oh, yeah.
Me too.
Haven't you?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I think we all have. Maybe that's a big assumption, but most of us have at some point in our lives. And this is a study to try to help doctors and health professionals identify which people are going to, most people get better in 4 to 6 weeks, but there's a handful of people that then go on to have more persistent, even disabling back pain.
Yeah, this was an article in the Journal of the American Medical Association, and they really wanted to look at the research that's been published really in its entirety in the medical literature to see what we can learn from all of the studies. And they identified 20 studies that have been out there really that had over 10,000 patients to look at things that might predict who is going to have really kind of chronic disabling low back pain, which is something that we really worry about, Christy, a lot, you know, because we know most people get better, but we don't want this disabling chronic low back pain.
And it'd be nice if we could identify those people who are at higher risk for having the long-term back pain, so maybe we could intervene earlier. So in this study, they tried to identify which of these factors could predict whether people are going to get better or not.
Yeah, and I think what I hear from this is not surprising, but it's also, I don't know, I felt a little troubling. And let's share what they found and then see what we think. But it's people who come into having this low back pain with what they call maladaptive pain coping behaviors, or they don't really deal with pain very well.
And they're talking about people who avoid work, don't move, or don't do any activities because they're afraid it might worsen their back.
Right.
They call that poor pain coping behaviors.
And those people do much worse. People who have depression or anxiety, who don't have really good health status in general, they do worse.
And people who have what they call functional impairment, meaning that the back pain at the onset makes them unable to get around and function in their daily activities.
Yeah. And the people who did better were people who didn't seem to be fearful or didn't avoid the pain there and who were functionally not very much impaired, they tended to do much better.
Yeah. So some of that is a little bit seems like common sense, that people who have worse back pain at the beginning that keeps them from walking, that they're more likely to have it be long term compared with people who don't.
Yeah, and I guess though there's this – and the things that were actually important, things that didn't relate to predicting low back pain, which was how much pain you had when you first came in and whether or not it was kind of radiating to your legs. If you had had this in the past, how old you were.
Whether or not
gender,
you liked to go to work.
Right. Those things didn't seem to have any relationship here. So perhaps maybe we could focus in on and let people know that if you're not tolerating pain very well – and you're not very mobile, may need to change your approach if you don't want to have chronic low back pain.
Yeah, certainly more study needs to be done. But what if we had better therapy for patients to help people cope with pain? Maybe that could help people get better sooner.
Yeah, it doesn't give us the answer, but
no. It
kind of moves us. And I think it's really food for fodder for all of us. What about our very next research that matters?
Our next one is about drinking and driving. And this was a study in the Journal of Health Communication to figure out what things can we discover that will predict alcohol-impaired driving among college students.
Yeah, you know, we know that, and I've got a son in college now, and I know that drinking on college campuses among 18 to 25-year-olds is really very pervasive in binge drinking. And yet we know their real risk is when they get behind a car to themselves and to others. And so this was a study that really looked at 330 18 to 25-year-olds to help understand better what the factors were that might predict whether they do drink and drive or don't drink and drive.
And what they found were that people who reported on this telephone survey to have higher levels of weekly alcohol use, if they were older than 21, if they perceived any difficulty in getting transportation when they were drinking, that those things were associated with a higher likelihood of drinking and driving.
Right. And that if they were worried about the consequences of drinking and driving, like having a wreck and killing someone or themselves, they had a lower likelihood of drinking and driving.
Yeah, and knowledge of the laws had no impact. So, I mean, this suggests to me that focusing our efforts to college students on either thinking about the consequences or some process where they have to think about consequences of drinking and driving or focusing on some of these other predictors may make more of a difference than just teaching people about the laws.
Right. We can't do a whole lot about their age. We can't do a whole lot about – we can certainly encourage lower levels of alcohol use, but we could perhaps do things about alternative transportation mm-hmm. and really work on that as a mechanism that seems to lower their risk. And
sure.
So I like this study. It's not a – huge study, Christy, but it's I think it has important findings.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. Well, our next one is about HPV vaccination and risky sexual behavior.
So human papillomavirus vaccination, for which 5-7 years ago really wasn't even available, knowledgeable, and now pretty much everyone's – most people are getting it done.
So this is the vaccine that helps prevent cervical cancer and is given to adolescent girls in order to prevent them catching the vaccine that then can cause cervical cancer.
And what this particular article in the Journal of Health Communication as well was really looking at is, well, the media is talking about this HPV vaccination and people are getting it. Is there more risky sexual behavior that's now occurring because the media is just talking about all the positives, and aren't there some potentially some negatives that kids who don't feel like they can get these diseases are going to engage in more sexually risky behaviors? And I wasn't so certain that that was the case.
Well, and this was looking at sort of how the media presents it. Is it more positive or negative? And, you know, do they use more of the hype about this promoting risky sexual behavior to get their media, you know, get people to listen? But in this, they found a minority of parents are actually concerned about teenagers engaging in risky sexual behavior following this vaccination. But yet there is a whole lot of talk about it.
Well, and they also found in looking at over 92 articles in 5 years, and this was in British national newspapers, that the newspapers seemed to provide the parents with very positive descriptions about the vaccinations. But they also did talk about that, you know, adolescents could engage in more risky sexual behaviors as well. So it seemed like the newspaper and the media was actually doing their job and doing it fairly responsibly.
Yeah.
That's how I read it.
Presenting both sides, which, you know, and that should be a conversation that parents then are stimulated from the media to have that conversation with their doctor and weigh those out.
I had not really thought about that much about the likelihood that adolescents would engage in more risky sexual behaviors knowing this. I had not even thought about that possibility, and yet I have a teenage daughter. And so, you know, it stimulates me to say, oh, maybe I should be more concerned. Maybe I should be having these conversations. But I don't blame the media for – it sounds like they're doing a good job.
Well, in this particular – I mean, looking at these studies in British national newspapers, yes. I'm not sure that holds true in America, but
come on.
We'll see.
We'll see. We'll see.
All right.
What about very last research that matters here?
Okay. This is really important. Yes.
Yeah, I agree.
Okay. So this is about the accuracy of computer-generated Spanish language medicine labels. So the labels that go on your medicines, if you're English-speaking, they're in English. But if you speak a different language, how do you know how to follow the directions of your medicines?
So if it says that you should take this medicine once a day for 11 days, is that – and that's what the doctor writes on the prescription. Is that what ends up on your medicine label? And then what happens – when you're Spanish speaking and you're trying to translate those directions into Spanish.
And once, O-N-C-E, looks like once or 11. So there are many mistakes that could be made if you translate it inappropriately or don't translate it at all
right.
to
and
people
they,
who are taking it.
And they found in this article in the journal Pediatrics that 73% of the time in an area which it was almost all Spanish-speaking patients that the pharmacies provided medicine labels in Spanish. And interestingly enough, I was surprised, Christy, to see that the chain pharmacies did the worst compared to hospital pharmacies that did a little bit better. But the best that were these independent pharmacies there. But the chain pharmacies did not provide these labels in Spanish very frequently. And again, all of the pharmacies, there was a very large error rate.
Well, and in the ones that did, half of the labels contained serious mistakes, such as telling someone to take it a medicine 11 times a day instead of once a day. So that's kind of scary.
So I don't think we're going to be able to get into a whole lot more about what we do about this and what should be done about this. But I think we at least highlight that there's a problem here. Those of you who are getting any labels in Spanish need to take even extra precautions, as would anyone getting labels, and to really make sure it's there.
Yep.
And we've had some other good research that matters today dealing with HPV vaccination and
low
media,
back pain,
and then drinking and driving and what we can do to improve that.
Mm-hmm. So that concludes our Research That Matters portion of the show. We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll be talking with Dr. Alex Creighton about shoulder injuries. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Here's to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
Here's to your health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Here's to Your Health.
Welcome back to UNC Family Medicine's Here's to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. And today on Conversations, we're going to be talking about one of the most common, really musculoskeletal orthopedic issues that happens in all of medicine, and I bet virtually every listener knows someone or they themselves have had a problem with their shoulder at some point in time. I think the latest statistics, Christy, are that over 7.5 million people went to the doctor's office for a shoulder problem each year in the United States, and these are incredibly debilitating for so many people. So it's really good to have someone here that can help us understand what we can do to treat them and maybe even prevent them.
Definitely. We are pleased to welcome Dr. Alex Creighton, who is an assistant professor in the Department of Orthopedics at UNC and team physician for the Tar Heels. Dr. Creighton received his medical degree from the Medical College of Virginia, Virginia Commonwealth University, and graduated a member of Alpha Omega Alpha Medical Society. After finishing his surgical internship and residency in orthopedics at the UNC School of Medicine, he completed his sports medicine fellowship at Rush University Medical Center in Chicago, Illinois. And while at Rush, he helped take care of the Chicago White Sox baseball team, Chicago Rush Arena football team, and the Chicago Steel hockey team. Dr. Creighton is certified by the American Board of Orthopedic Surgery and holds a subspecialty certification in orthopedic sports medicine. So we're so glad to have you with us, Dr. Creighton.
Glad to be here.
You know, I think I just want to jump right in a little bit and, you know, listening a little bit to your bio, Dr. Creighton, knowing you as well, I want to know, how did you get interested? You know, orthopedics has so many different areas to get involved in, and knees and hips and backs and, you know, different parts, hands, feet, the shoulder. Among other things, I know that's not the only thing you do, but how did you get so interested in really becoming such an expert in shoulders?
Well, like you said in your statement, a lot of people do have shoulder problems, and I was one of those people in college. Playing baseball in college hurt my shoulder that required a surgery on it, and I think that's kind of always been in the back of my mind. I can kind of empathize with those types of patients, and it's always been a level of great interest for me. So I think that started the ball rolling, so to speak.
Well, we're glad you followed your passion there. When we talk about shoulder injuries, there are lots of different types of shoulder injury. Could you review a few of them? I know there's a rotator cuff injury and different problems you can have, but review a few, few of the more common ones for us?
Definitely rotator cuff injuries is probably the thing we see the most of. But
now, we talk about rotator cuff. Define for our listeners what actually you mean by that term.
Well, a rotator cuff is a set of four muscles that kind of engulf or encase your humeral head and really are the main powers that move it in certain positions, particularly over the shoulder. It is, you know, something you use every day, and obviously with any type of sports, you use it all the time. So there's a constellation of symptoms that, you know, usually start in the 30s, early 40s, where you can start developing some bursitis or impingement, partial thickness tears. But usually people don't get full rotator cuff tears until they're in their 50s or even above 60. And that's really where it's an epidemic amongst the older patients.
Just because of wear and tear chronically, arthritis, why does it tend to kind of happen? Is it like arthritis of the knee? It happens as you get older?
Yeah. Well, I think it's just one of the areas that definitely weakens as we age. It's got there's a portion of the tendon between the supraspinatus and infraspinatus that have a poor blood supply, and that's the area that the tear usually starts. Now, I think the things that we're still trying to figure out are why some people are symptomatic and others aren't. Some people can tolerate a small partial tear or a full thickness tear very well.
So if you tear one or two muscles, you might still be able to function pretty well, but you might have some pain, versus you tear two, three, four, you got a real problem.
Correct.
Well, I mean, speaking of ability to function, what are the main limitations in function if you tear your rotator cuff? I mean, how do you know other than my shoulder hurts?
Well, first is pain, but then certain movements over your shoulder level. Sometimes people have a lot of pain initiating emotion.
So raising your arm up over like you did throwing baseball or serving a tennis ball.
And the other thing, you know, for a full rotator cuff tear, a lot of people have pain at nighttime, trying to go to sleep when they're relaxed. The tear does not support the shoulder very well, and that's one of the more common things that brings people to see us in orthopedics is pain at nighttime.
Hmm. Well, so a lot of people are going to get this as they get older. Some people are going to get this when they're younger and they're doing some activities. Before we get into talking about some of the other major common shoulder problems, if you're developing and you've torn one of the muscles or a partial tear of your rotator cuff, can you just do physical therapy and will it get better?
Yeah, a lot of times it can get better. A lot of times if your shoulder is still strong, you can initiate some good strengthening exercises with a therapist that can really, a lot of times, that's all you have to do. It's the patient that still has pain after appropriate therapy or some deficiencies in some of their strength that I think have the more that are more problematic and are more likely to go to surgery. The other thing is if it's a gradual process or an acute process, sometimes if it's something that's truly degenerative that, you know, started as a partial tear, got a little bit bigger, sometimes people have the ability to adapt so it's not as problematic in their everyday life, whereas if they fell or some traumatic event lifting a piece of luggage over a carrier on an airplane, they had acute event, those are the patients that I think have more problems because they haven't had the ability to adapt.
I see. So before we get into the treatment options or other types of shoulder injuries, is there anything we can do as we age to keep our shoulders and our rotator cuffs nice and healthy and strong to try to prevent having a tear?
Well, I think smoking is a big risk factor. Just
so
like
not smoking.
For
not
rotator
smoke.
Cuff tears.
Correct.
Wow.
Including
another reason,
not to smoke. Reason number 236A. Okay, good.
And then I think just like a lot of things, it's a matter of staying in shape and staying strong and flexible as we get a little bit older. Those are the things that we lose flexibility-wise, including, you know, hip, knees, and all your joints.
Mm-hmm. So staying active.
We're talking with Dr. Alex Creighton from the UNC Department of Orthopedics and also team physician for the Tar Heels about shoulder injuries. And I know we're going to take a break in just a minute, Dr. Creighton, but you know, what are the interventions if this physical therapy and this tincture of time really aren't working? What are the next two or three things you're going to do to really help? Because I guess the goal is to get people back to where they were either before the injury or even better than where they were.
I think if a patient is struggling doing the regular conservative things like rest, activity modification, and doing some strengthening with therapy, sometimes we'll try a steroid injection to decrease some inflammation that may be affecting their ability to advance in therapy. The other thing is obtaining an MRI so we can, or an ultrasound that can, you know, truly tell us what's going on. Because if they have a, you know, small to medium sized tear, those are the ones that we can do a better job fixing them surgically, as opposed to some massive tear that has a little bit less of a success.
But you don't run into the MRIs. One of my things that I hear from a lot of patients, you know, is they seem to push me, or I feel wanting to be pushed to getting an MRI right up front. They want to know exactly what's going on right up front. You don't do that necessarily at the outset, or do you?
And doing it early isn't as helpful, right?
Well, I think it depends a little bit on how long their symptoms have been going, what happened traumatically,
sure,
how bad their physical exam is. If they just have some pain with certain arm movements, I certainly do not recommend getting an MRI, because there's a good percentage of patients that will be made better conservatively. Now, if they come in after a fall and they can't elevate their hand over their waist, that's something that we want to know about quicker, because we can sometimes, if they had an acute tear, we can do a better job fixing that earlier.
Well, we're going to need to take a short break. We're having a really interesting conversation with our guest, Dr. Alex Creighton, about shoulder injuries. And we'll be right back. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Here's to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Here's to Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Here's to your health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Here's to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We have been talking with Dr. Alex Creighton of UNC Department of Orthopedics about shoulder injuries. And just before the break, we were talking about rotator cuff injuries. But I know, Dr. Creighton, you mentioned some other injuries to the shoulder as well, like bursitis or frozen shoulder. Could you speak a little bit to what those experiences are like for patients?
Well, a frozen shoulder, it's also known as adhesive capsulitis, which is really just an inflammatory process that happens a lot of times for no known reason, which is frustrating to the patient and for the physician treating the patient. It's more common in people with diabetes sometimes and thyroid problems, but the vast majority of time it's just idiopathic, meaning we're not sure why it happens.
This is one that's really painful.
Yeah, it usually has three phases. There's an inflammatory phase, a frozen phase, and then a resolution phase. And those each of those phases can take 3 to 4 months. So at times it can take up to a year to improve. A lot of times you're trying to do things symptomatically to make the patient feel a little bit better and gradually progress their motion to get out of that frozen phase and into the resolution phase.
Well, and just in the interest of disclosure, Dr. Creighton knows, because he helped treat me. I had a frozen shoulder, probably starting as a result of a fall off a ladder in which I fell on my back, maybe fell on my shoulder, and then 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 weeks later developing pain. And I'm a pretty active athlete, tennis player, and it got to the point where I couldn't even hit a serve. I could still hit the ball, you know, forehands and backhands, but I couldn't serve. I couldn't throw a frisbee. And pain, as you mentioned, Dr. Creighton, that was really painful, particularly at night when I tried to sleep, so bad that I couldn't sleep for months until we came up with a regimen. And as you said, but in my case, it actually almost took 2 years for it to get 95% resolved.
Correct.
So what did Dr. Creighton do to help you?
First off, he validated the fact that I had something that was really significant and could be incredibly painful, and that would get better.
And that was helpful, just to hear that, yes, this really hurts.
Well, yeah, and also knowing that it's not the torn rotator cuff or these other things. And also, to your credit, Dr. Creighton, you didn't push me into surgery. You said, I recall that surgery could help, but it also may not help. And that's an important thing to hear, and you wouldn't necessarily always expect that from an orthopedic surgeon, that to say that surgery may not help.
That is correct.
So with adhesive capsulitis or frozen shoulder, people do get better with some anti-inflammatories.
Yeah, it's sometimes anti-inflammatories. Sometimes they even need a low-dose narcotic. Sometimes glenohumeral injection can be very helpful, but that's an injection inside the shoulder joint and not the subacromial space like a lot of people have for bursitis or rotator cuff issues. So there is a difference there. And then some therapy is helpful, but sometimes you can overdo it trying to push it, and you take a step forward and then two steps back. So it's kind of controlled therapy, stretching to what's comfortable and trying to do a little bit more each week as opposed to several times a day.
Yeah, I found the physical therapy, and you've mentioned this for rotator cuff as well, and I'm sure it's going to be part of your, you probably have a physical therapist on your right and left hip there, but that was really an important piece of getting my range of motion back there, which was critical.
I think it's really helpful to have a good therapist, but, sometimes it's just helpful to check in, every week or every other week just to make sure you're still doing okay, not plateauing, and then sometimes an injection at that point is helpful.
Great. I know the other shoulder injury we were going to touch on was AC joint separation, which just the word joint separation sounds awful. Tell us about what that means and who that happens with.
Well, it happens a lot in contact athletes or bike riders, mountain bikers that fall kind of over their handlebars. We see it a lot in our football players, sometimes our wrestlers. But it can happen to anybody if they fall directly onto their shoulder. And it's basically your AC joint or acromioclavicular joint is the joint between your acromion and clavicle, and it has a set of ligaments. Some are just the AC ligaments, and some are the coracoclavicular ligaments. And a significant sprain disrupts all those ligaments and sometimes requires a surgery. But most of the time, they're either grade 1, 2, or 3 that can be treated conservatively. The ones that go to 4, 5, and 6 are the ones that are really obvious and really impressive on physical exam.
So yeah. These are usually young people?
Correct. But, it can happen to anybody if you fall off a ladder or fall off your bike. Again, those I see quite a few people back behind Chapel High School on those trails that sometimes have tipped over their handlebars and will be seeing us the next week.
Yeah, I've got a disclosure here, too. Unfortunately, I recall.
Do you fall a lot?
No, but I was in college and we'd bunked our beds and come home at night one evening after those bunks were and I forgot that they were bunked when I got up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom and went straight down and didn't recall a whole lot till 2 days later. And my roommate said, "Adam, what's wrong with your shoulder?" And sure enough, today, that right shoulder, because I guess a lot of people can live with this problem, and I really don't have pain, but I don't like to do push-ups with my right shoulder.
Correct. Again, if it's a mild injury, you can have some abnormality or your clavicle can be up a little bit higher, but a lot of those patients do fine without any type of surgical intervention.
Now, we've seen a lot of – what about some surgery? What things do you actually do surgery for? Because there are a lot of folks. We saw Roy Williams in a sling this year and so surgery is part of the armamentarium. What do you have to do surgery for and what's the success rate?
Well, it depends, again, what the surgery is. Coach Williams had a tear of his lining of his shoulder socket, which, usually, again, happens in people that dislocate their shoulder. It's usually a younger patient's injury, but he took a fall on the golf course and slipped, and he had a bad tear that, required us to reattach it. Rotator cuff, if they fail conservatively or have an acute event where they're really debilitated, we'll get a surgery. We do a better job repairing small to medium-sized tears than we do large or massive. So there is some benefit to getting to it before it's too big. And then really going on the other spectrum, the younger athlete, a throwing athlete, they can sometimes also have tears of the lining of their shoulder socket called the labrum, particularly on their superior part with baseball players or young tennis players or softball pitchers as well.
And surgery can help with that?
Correct.
Now, speaking of throwing athletes, you mentioned NIH grant about young athletes earlier when we were talking. Could you share that a little bit with our listeners?
Dr. Joe Myers, who's a PhD in exercise and physiology department at UNC, has an NIH grant that I have my name on it, but he's the primary principal investigator, where he's kind of going across the state of North Carolina looking at young athletes with an ultrasound to determine how much changes in their bone. A lot of people think that these younger throwing athletes actually have some permanent changes to their proximal humerus, so they're, and for lack of a better term, they're a little bit more twisted, meaning they have more version in their humerus, which can put some more stress on some of their rotator cuff or lining of their shoulder socket, the labrum, and it's just a way that we're trying to figure out, you know, if there's a critical mass or a critical amount of torsion on their proximal humerus that could be more significant or contribute to more injuries.
Well, you know, it's the preventing of serious injuries in young athletes with the push that everyone seems to be doing. And I've got children who play tennis and other sports, and really preventing that. But one thing I need to ask you, because you have been a team physician for lots of different sports, is to what extent are steroids contribute to any of the shoulder types of injuries we see? Is that a
you mean steroids that kids take to pump themselves up, steroid injections?
Yeah, steroid use in athletes. Are any of these shoulder injuries that are out there related to the use of steroids by these kids and athletes?
I think they certainly contribute to it's a little bit like a little bit in moderation would probably benefit some people, but the problem is that they're not controlled substances. You don't know what you're getting, and you, particularly for a young athlete, they will break down and cause further damage, not only to their joints, but also particularly to their liver and other organs, which you guys know more than I do, but have some significant side effects too. I think specifically speaking for an high school athlete or a college athlete, you know, they get tested at UNC and, you know, I think they're a little bit more difficult to come by. But at the same time, I'm sure some younger athletes are trying to take them because their performance, you know, at least in the short run, may be improved. But I think in the long run, you don't get any benefit.
It's like getting an injection in your shoulder. If you did it every month, even from a doctor, you would have some really significant deterioration of your shoulder.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
Well, Dr. Creighton, we can't thank you enough for being with us today to have this conversation.
Well, I really appreciate it. I enjoyed talking to you guys and really enjoy listening to your show.
And for all you do for the Tar Heels.
Thank you very much.
And I know we're going to be hopefully talking about a new feature on our show in the coming months about really bringing more sports medicine and muscle injuries. So I'm hoping you'll be able to have a more regular communication with us about some of these really important issues. So
that'd be great.
Thank you very much.
We've been talking with Dr. Alex Creighton of the UNC Department of Orthopedics, and we're going to take a break. But coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Here's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Here's to your health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Here's to Your Health.
Welcome back to UNC Family Medicine's Here's to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about your questions, your experiences, your attitudes towards medical care.
You can send in your own questions to us, and we'll talk about them on an upcoming show. You can send them to yourhealth@unc.edu. And now our executive producer, Julie Steiner, will talk to us about our very first House Call.
Our first listener writes, I have an ache in my right elbow and forearm for several weeks. It only hurts when I try to open a jar or turn a doorknob. It feels better when I massage it, but it won't go away. Someone said it could be tennis elbow, but I don't play tennis. Any ideas on what it could be and how to make it go away?
Well, I'm sorry you're hurting. It sounds like, I mean, it's always hard to say with this little bit of information, but it sounds like it really could be tennis elbow or something called lateral epicondylitis, which is the fancy word for tennis elbow.
Yeah, you know, I wish we just had our great guest one, Dr. Creighton, and we should like, Dr. Creighton, come back here. We have an elbow question. I know it's not a shoulder, but, you know, and what's interesting is as you're opening and you're turning your forearm, you can actually, if that turns turning of the forearm, open and close, we call it supination and pronation, medical terms. If you can pinpoint a spot on your elbow that as you turn, it hurts, that frequently is this lateral epicondylitis and inflammation. And it doesn't occur just from tennis. It can occur from golf and occur from really anything that you're doing.
Any repetitive
motion. That aggravated a particular area, usually from doing something the way you shouldn't be doing it.
Sure. And the good news is that most people get better. You can take anti-inflammatory medicines. You can do ice or massage. You mentioned massage helps, and there's nothing wrong with, you know, with either giving yourself a massage or getting a massage. And you can also get a band at the store or from your doctor oftentimes that wraps around and puts pressure on that spot that causes pain.
Yeah. Some people, if these things don't work, may try actually acupuncture. And there's some data, not great, but some data that it not only reduces the pain and helps the pain, but it may have the reducing inflammation. One thing that doesn't appear to work, unfortunately, are magnets. And we've talked about that on the show
before. Oh, we did talk about that.
That doesn't really work. But
and sometimes a doctor might recommend a steroid injection if these what we call conservative medicines, like the anti-inflammatories and ice and those things, if those don't work, a steroid injection might be indicated.
Yeah, but you're going to have to avoid if you're doing something that's precipitating this. Like, if, for instance, if like a lot of times people hit a backhand on tennis, and the backhand they're hitting it abnormal, and it's creating the strain. And so, what times I'll work with them, I used to teach tennis, is I will have them go if they had a one-handed backhand, give them a two-handed backhand, because then they're using that left hand and they're taking the pressure off that right hand. So you might have to make some actually changes in what you're doing.
Sure. Okay, Julie, what do we have next?
I'm a massage therapist, and when I was talking to one of my clients, he told me that he has not been to the doctor in over 5 years and that he has diabetes. He said his morning blood sugars are in the 200s and he takes no medication. He doesn't want to take medicine, and it doesn't seem like he really understands the need to get his diabetes under control. He said he didn't like to go to doctors who just lecture him, and I actually told him about the two of you and recommended he make an appointment with you at the Family Medicine Center. Do you have any other ideas?
Well,
thanks for the referral.
Thanks for the referral. And we better not lecture today, Christy.
No,
we're going to disappoint everyone here. But my first thing is, yes, there is about 42 other ideas I have relating to other doctors at the Family Medicine Center. He needs to get in to see a doctor, whether it's one of our family medicine attendings or residents or any family practice physician or primary care physician. Anyone that can help him take care of his diabetes, you're absolutely right.
And good for you for caring enough to help him try to find a doctor that he can connect with. Because, you know, a lot of times it is that connection, that ability to trust a doctor that may help him get over this desire not to take medicine and help him really want to take charge of his health. So thank you for caring enough to refer him.
And what we would actually talk with them about is also really taking control. So that's why lecturing, that's not who we are. It's not how we're trained to do this. So having a conversation, and you can have that same conversation with him as well, that if he has goals, we can help him achieve those goals there.
Yep.
Julie, what's our very next house call?
My 6-year-old has some bumps on his chest and right side. They were small bumps, but now they've gotten bigger. My pediatrician told me it was a common wart called molluscum and that it would go away without treatment. But I took him to my dermatologist, and she gave him a treatment for them called blister beetle that made them blister and go away. Who was right?
That's a great question. And as with many things, Christy and I, we're not always politically correct. And I'm not saying we're being politically correct here, but your dermatologist was right and your doctor was right.
Yep,
and we'll
both
tell you how they were both right.
So molluscum contagiosum is caused by a virus, and it's transmitted from skin to skin. So it's really common in children, and they can get it from just rubbing up against another kid who has these molluscum on their body.
And a good majority of them will go away over time. However, some may not. And we can't really predict easily which ones are going to go away or not. And so frequently, as a primary care doctor, we'll say, you know, no treatment is oftentimes a good treatment, particularly if they're not bothersome, they're not numerous, and they're not getting bigger. But yours did get bigger.
Sure. And usually they go away in weeks to months. But some people, in thinking about whether or not to have treatment for them, you want to think about, are there other medical issues? Like, are you getting infections on top of that? Or is it really uncomfortable to the child with a lot of itching? Or
if you have a child that's beginning up in summer and they're on their chest and it's a boy and they're outside all the time without their shirt on, other kids may see it, make fun. I mean, there's all kinds of self-image issues here that and the treatment is usually relatively benign, though it can be a little painful.
So there are lots of different treatment options, from freezing them. If there are only a couple of them, you could freeze some. Other surgical options, as well as different medications you can put on them to basically destroy them.
Yeah, and the treatment that the dermatologist just recommended is an extract from the blister beetle, and it's not Food and Drug Administration approved, but it is commonly used. There are some prescribed medicines, one called imiquimod, but it's fairly expensive, but it can be effective that. And then there's some other things that are really less effective that the dermatologist probably wouldn't use, things that some drug trials that have not been shown to be effective, but maybe some surgery, which would be a last-ditch option.
Yep. So good question, and good news is he'll get better probably either way. Julie, do we have time for our last question real quick?
I found a tick on my son yesterday. It was lodged on his neck, but not swollen or fat. It was easy to remove with tweezers, and I'm sure I got the whole thing. There's no rash, and he seems fine. Do I need to take him to the doctor?
Quick answer is no.
No.
I tell people to mark your calendar and follow it out for 14 to 21 days. And if your son were to get fever, rash, headache, sick, take him to the doctor immediately.
Yep. Better answer. Okay. Well, that's going to probably conclude our house calls today. We've talked about ticks and molluscum and tennis elbow.
And a little bit about
diabetes.
Diabetes, that's right, and getting in with a doctor. So thank you for joining us today for Here's to Your Health, and we hope we've addressed some issues and concerns that are important to you. We want you to email us at yourhealth@unc.edu and follow us on Twitter.
We'd like to thank WCHL, the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, our producer Julie Steiner, and our guest today, Dr. Alex Creighton.
And on behalf of the UNC Department of Family Medicine, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and we'll look forward to talking with you on Here's to Your Health again next week.
Take care.
Here's to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Here's to Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. You can also go to our website at 1360WCHL.com and click on WCHL On Demand. Here's to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine at News Talk 1360 WCHL.